CRG Secrets of Success interview series, and it's my delight to have the founder, the one that started all of this, Dr. Terry Anderson, on the phone today with us. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ken.
And Terry, of course, we've been friends for a long time, and dear friends, I would say. But to expand on and let people know sort of your background, let people know sort of your, not the history of the company, but the history of Terry and where you've come and your journey and sort of your expertise in the field for the last 40 years or so.
Well, do you want me to answer that in one sentence, Ken, or would you like that in a...
Well, I know that it's going to take a little longer, but you just go ahead and just give us your background. You have an opportunity to, if you want to strengthen your resume right now, you just go for it.
Well, I think what I might do is just talk about my background in relationship to the development of the tools that CRG has.
Well, that's true, but I also it's also good as we have a conversation here that people have a background about who you are. You started out as a university professor and teaching psychology, but what else were you teaching back 30 or 40 years ago?
I started out teaching interpersonal communication and problem solving for people who are going to go into social work, into corrections, and into policing. And in my earlier days, even those students, some of the students I had were going into early childhood education programs.
Mm-hmm. And then that progressed into what from there?
Well, I really have been teaching those same courses, except I've added leadership and change management to the graduate level courses that I've taught.
And so you have a master's. Go ahead.
Well, I also have ended up teaching executive coaching at Royal Roads University as well.
So you have a master's degree in?
Well, it's an education with a specialization in counseling.
And then your PhD is in?
It's in administration and management with a specialization in organization development.
So with that kind of as a mindset, and you, I mean, your heart, Terry, is really to educate and train and equip other people to be successful in life, and especially, you know, in the law enforcement sort of sphere, but others as well, CEOs and working at the highest levels. But take us back, Terry, where, you know, you were teaching psychology courses and communication courses back in the 70s, early 80s, and you were using different assessments and tools at that time and having some frustrations with them. So just tell us a little bit about that, the how this all came about, where the personal style indicator and CRG was birthed.
Well, I guess it started in a class where I was using the DISC tool, and some of my students were having a hard time accepting that the profile that they were getting was actually appropriate for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a difficult time understanding why that would be, because mine happened to be fairly close. So I began doing some research. And my colleague and I did some research with a group of about 100 customs officers and about 100 correctional officers. And what we found out when we administered the DISC tool to them was that the distribution of scores that they got on the DISC was really controlled by the inside table that... if you've ever seen the DISC, there's a table in there that assigns specific profiles based on the configuration of scores that you got. And that was supposedly, that table was created based on supposed norms. And I later found out those norms were based on University of Minnesota freshman norms. And so that meant that everybody, whatever profile anybody got from that point forward, was determined on that particular data set.
Mm-hmm.
So no wonder my students were frustrated. And so I stopped using it at that point, and we had to recommend that the government would stop using the tools as well, because there was a flaw in how, in the very design itself. So I just decided I wanted to create something more accessible, simpler, and more straightforward, but nevertheless, and more accurate than what I had been using. So I spent a summer in my upstairs attic, where I had an office, writing the in-depth interpretations and first the word list and the in-depth interpretations. And then later, when I pilot tested it with my students, of course, we ended up revising that word list and refining it. And then I further developed the in-depth interpretations.
So where did
that
go ahead?
That just continued on for years, that refinement process. And go ahead. What question do you have?
Well, just to digress for a second, you also had been using the MBTI in some courses at some time too. So why didn't you go over to that or use that tool at that time?
Well, not really in courses, but I had done it myself, and I administered it to some individuals that I had worked with on a one-on-one basis. And one time I was speaking at a conference of executives, and I asked them to stand up if they had completed the MBTI. And of course, probably two-thirds of the room had completed it at one time or another in their career. And then I asked them to remain standing if they could remember their four letters. Well, about 70% of them sat down. And then I asked them to remain standing if they could remember what the four letters meant. And about two-thirds of those people sat down. And then I asked what percentage to remain standing if you can if you actually use the MBTI theory in practice in how you relate to people. And there were only about six people out of a couple hundred people in the room who remained standing at the end of that four questions. So that just said to me, it's not an easily accessible tool. Everybody there depended upon a certified professional to interpret the results for them, because they were told they couldn't interpret them themselves.
Right.
And I just sort of became fed up with that whole exclusivism and the idea that psychology can't be made available to anyone. And so I just said, why wouldn't we create something that's memorable, that's based on an integrative theory rather than just one theory, and something that would be practical and useful to anybody, regardless of their background. So that's what I set out to design, and that was how the idea of developing a personal style indicator came into being. Rather than a test, it was just an indicator of preference.
And about where they're at. And one of the things, you know, just for our listeners' purposes, if they're not familiar, DISC is based on Marston's work, MBTI on Carl Jung's, Wilson Learning Social Styles on Merrill Reed's. But you looked at all of these as you brought together sort of the PSI theory and model. And what was your thinking between just bringing these all together?
Well, I didn't really bring them all together. I examined those and many other theories. And what I found was they all have some kind of assumptions that really hadn't been verified or validated in a kind of a useful way. They were maybe validated with isolated groups, or maybe validated, or claims for validation, even predictive validity were made about the DISC in their Hawaii study. And they claimed that they could identify who the best bank manager would be if they could just find out what the applicant's profile, DISC profile was.
Mm.
And they published a study where they made the claim of predictive ability to predict a bank manager's success based on his profile. And it just doesn't hold water. Not only that study didn't hold water, but the whole concept of using an ipsative assessment to predict something without comparing it to another tool that's been validated in the real world, you can't make claims like that. It just doesn't, it's not credible.
We just finished having a conversation with Richard Nodell, and one of the things that he was just emphatic about, which is I'm 100% agree, and I think that you do too, is that style patterns should not be used to predict the career path that you go down.
No, it's just one indicator amongst many, and when I have my students complete the personal style indicator, and all of them are in the career planning process, I suggest to them that they need to take a look at the work behavioral style requirements of the job and compare that to their preference pattern. So it's a very useful thing to do, but it doesn't tell you what you should do. It probably more steers you away from careers that you just don't prefer to act like. For example, somebody who's very highly cognitive, or somebody who's, let's just say, an even more clear example, who's not very cognitive at all and doesn't like details and doesn't like to double-check things, should probably not be an accountant or a bank teller or a banker. They maybe could do it, but they're probably not going to prefer to do it. And who wants to be in a job that you really don't prefer to do the work in for a long time?
Or they could be, Terry, in a different part of that field where they are the business development manager for the accounting firm, and they are the strategic strategist for tax planning, and then they have some other people that give them all the details.
Exactly. In fact, I ended up advising one accountant who had his own firm that he needed to move into that role, and he ended up getting certified as a certified management accountant rather than just a chartered accountant.
And they count.
And he hired other people to count the beans, and he ended up advising business owners about financial strategy.
And you know, that's the intentional or the proactive side. So let's digress for a second, and I'm sorry I interrupted your steps there, where you were putting the PSI together, and then you were validating the word list with your students. How did you determine, you know, what words would be in each sort of dimension and that they wouldn't cross over?
Well, I just put all, at that time we only had 16 words per category. So we only had 64 words and we didn't have the definitions attached to them. So I just put 64 words on the blackboard and I put four quadrants beside it. And the four quadrants were action, analysis, harmony, and expression. And I asked them to place the words in the categories in the quadrant where they felt they best belonged. And I just kept doing that and kept revising the words until pretty much nobody disagreed. And that was how the original word list got refined before I printed the very first version of it and sold it to the Justice Institute of BC, where they're still using it in corrections for training.
And so your intent when you first put this together was never really intended to sell this. You wanted to create something for your classes, did you not?
Yeah, and one of my students took it to the Justice Institute, and the training director saw it and said, hey, we'd really like to use this, and I said, well, go ahead, you know, use it. Photocopy it. Use it all you want. And they said, no, we can't really do that. And we want you to print it up so it's pretty and looks nice. And, you know, we have to pay for it because we can't just use materials without having, you know, them be a part of our system of ordering. And so why don't you print some for us? So I printed 1,000. They bought 500. And the next year they bought another 500. And so I asked, they said, well, how much do you want for these? And I said, well, I don't know, what? Cost me 50 cents a piece to print them, so 50 cents. And he said, no. You spent a lot of time putting this together. They should be at least $5. I said, well, if you have a budget for it, you know, I'm not going to argue with you. So I don't know if you do math, but 500 times, you know, $5 times 500 is $2,500, which more than five times covered my expenses for printing. So I began thinking that there, you know, this had business applications, even though I wasn't a business person and wasn't trying to be. So I just sort of, you know, I got more requests to print more copies and ran a little business out of my basement.
And so your design, your insights, really obviously were being accepted out there. But what were some, before we kind of go forward into the history of the company, what were some other things that you were thinking about that were very important in the design of the PSI that you wanted to ensure were part of it as a philosophy, as a thinking, so that you didn't run into some of the same problems that other assessments or frustrations that you were having other assessments in the market?
I wanted it to be written in plain English. I wanted it to be memorable. I wanted it to be useful. I wanted it to be perceived as accurate, and not just in a accurate in a horoscope way, but accurate in a quite a comprehensive way. I wanted it to people to say after they finished it, yes, that's really more like me than, and more clearly describes me than I could have described myself by myself before.
Mm.
And so once I wrote the in-depth interpretations, I gave the first draft to my students, and I asked them to choose amongst the 20 in-depth interpretations, or 21 at the time, whichever ones were most like them. And they chose the ones that matched their scores, even though they didn't know which ones matched their scores. So that helped us to verify that when you go through the word list and make your rank-ordered selections, you're going to end up with the same profile that you would pick if you read all the in-depth interpretations. So that's another way to say that the constructs have some validity and that they mean what they say they mean, and that people are interpreting them in such a way as that they validate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that the profile you'd get if you were to use the rank ordered word list would be the same profile you'd get if you read all of the in-depth interpretations and selected your top two. So that was kind of evidence for me that we were on the right track, developing something that was streamlined, refined, that was perceived to be relevant, important, and valid from a personal point of view. Not valid from a predictive point of view, because I wasn't trying to achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to help people communicate more clearly about themselves and understand other people better, and which they said this did help them do.
Now, one of the things that's in the PSI, and I believe it's one of the brilliance of it, is that just about every other assessment that is a primary sort of comparison or competitor to the PSI has 16 patterns. So there's 16 types in CURSI and MBTI. There's 16 patterns and DISC. How did you come up with the fact that Syrgy, we have 21, and the additional five, or the triple high and the four even, or the synergistic profile, what was your thinking behind that? How did you determine that or have that breakthrough?
It wasn't really my thinking. It's just the way people describe themselves. Some people describe themselves as being like three of the four styles, and they prefer all three of those styles out of the four, and they don't prefer the fourth style. And a few people, about 5%, have what we were then calling the undifferentiated profile, which we now call the synergistic profile. And that's where people have all four scores close to the midline, which means they prefer to act relatively equally in all four styles. And there's nothing right or wrong or good or bad about that. It's just the way they describe themselves. And it doesn't mean that they're better or worse or have more flexibility or less flexibility than somebody else, because whatever profile you end up with isn't a measure of how versatile you are. It's just a measure of how you prefer to act in those four major behavioral style areas.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the key points, though, is that many of the other assessments do not acknowledge, Terry, the triple high or four even profile. In fact, there was an assessment out there that would say that if you have a tight pattern, meaning even, go back and take it again because your scores are wrong.
Well, yes, or they don't even allow you to get more than one profile.
Well, that's another point, is that and we have mentioned that with some of the other interviews that we've done with users, is that CRG, I'm not aware of other tools, maybe there is, but most of the major ones, you only get one profile or pattern. You don't get more than that. So what was your thinking behind that?
The DISC has, they're offering what they call a backup profile or a profile under stress, and then they have a third profile, which is the average of those two. And that just didn't wash when I had used the DISC with well over 100 students. Many of them said, no, my backup profile is not, that's not how I act at all, and I don't prefer to do that ever, and it's not how I act under stress. So I just didn't think subtracting the scores that you had for the things you checked you're most like from the things that you're least like was going to produce some kind of magical truth. It just doesn't make any logical sense to subtract the words that you said you're most like from the ones you're least like, and then you come up with a third profile that you're supposed to be like under stress. There's no logic to that whatsoever, and there's no research behind it. Mm-hmm. It just is a, I don't know why they did it or what they based it on. I couldn't find it in the manual. But whether they have more than one profile option isn't really the issue so much as they're basically pigeonholing you. And that's the other thing that we wanted to avoid. We wanted to avoid the idea that, while we know from the literature that people tend to have fairly consistent preferences over time. If you measure their preferences now, a year from now, 5 years from now, mm-hmm. most people's will stay relatively similar with some variation, and not a lot of variation.
Right. So in our words, we say your pattern stays the same. Maybe your scores adjust slightly, but the pattern is more than likely going to be very similar.
Right. Now that's, it's just, there are theories about why that's the case. And one theory that we found was based in the research of Isink, who basically proposed that people are born with certain kinds of nervous systems, and that their reticular activation system, if they're a very sensitive baby and they cry very easily at a loud noise, they're probably going to jump just about as much when they're adults, because they're born with that nervous system, and that nervous system is going to stay with them throughout their life. There is some evidence for that. However, we can't know for sure if that's true, if that's really the case. We can just say, it seems as though there's some credence we can give to that.
Well, and of course, one of the things that we teach is that your personal style stays tight or similar throughout your lifetime for the most part, but your personality, which is the totality of who you are, can mature, can develop. And we've had those discussions where, am I a developed person or an undeveloped? So I could have the identical
right.
style as you, and one showing maturity and the skill sets that you teach to police officers. If they have those skill sets come to bear, then it seems like they're different, but their preferences are the same.
Yeah, and the PSI doesn't measure competence at all. It only measures preference for certain kinds of style behaviors over others. And that's all it's claiming to measure.
The other one is that something like an MBTI or a CURSI, they use either or selection. So you have to be extroverted or introverted. And one of the things you did in the PSI model, which is, again, the underpinning to developing the whole thing, is that you allow people to have balanced or tight profiles. So I could, in essence, have introversion and extroversion as equally influencing me.
Right.
Or people and task, and many other tools don't allow you to do that. So what was your thinking behind that, and how did you come up with that?
We had a discussion, a couple of my colleagues and I, about the personal style theory and model. And if you can picture a bubble, people are like, you know, if you blow bubbles when you're a kid, they have a certain amount of elasticity, and they are in a certain kind of shape in four dimensions. And some bubbles are pear-shaped, and other bubbles are elongated if they get stretched or if they're stretching into certain tasks or preferences. And we just said, why don't we think in three dimensions rather than two? And why don't we allow people the freedom to move within those three dimensions rather than forcing them to choose between two options? And then if they say they're extroverted, then we put a stamp on them saying that's what they are. We just think that doesn't really make any sense. It makes sense if you want to seem like you're telling people some truth about themselves, but that's not really the truth. The truth is that we're multidimensional, we're flexible. In various situations, we have different amounts of versatility, and with various people, all of that varies. And not only that, we can learn to develop more style versatility and develop new behaviors that we hadn't engaged in before based on we get a new job or we have a new relationship with someone that requires us to become more sensitive or more responsive or more analytical. We can learn how to stretch into those new behaviors that we didn't originally prefer. It doesn't mean we're changing who we are or our personality. It just means that we're developing more style versatility.
And our ability for that versatility is unique to each person. We don't measure that, and I'm not aware of other tools that measure that either.
No, I don't know of a tool that measures versatility of style.
So in that, that's our own sort of developmental level that comes to play as we work with the tools.
Well, we've talked about one of the ways that we can help people assess how much versatility of style they have is we just ask them to read all 20 in-depth interpretations, all 21, and pick out the ones that they believe and others believe that they actually do stretch into. And the most I've ever seen anybody say that they're like is about 8.
Which is a lot.
It is a lot, and but that's a lot of versatility. Most people never go past 3.
I would agree with that for sure. And that's the majority of them.
So if most people read all 20, and I've had, I don't know how many hundreds of people take the time to read all 20 and select the ones that they prefer, and pretty much without exceptions, they're saying those other ones that I didn't select, I'm not going to go act like them. You can count on it. I won't. So it's a matter of willingness, and it's a matter of preference becomes a matter of willingness to a certain point.
And or comfort, and again, one of our definitions, your definitions you came up with, is that this natural predisposition. So for some of us, certain behaviors, it doesn't mean we can't do it, but it feels unnatural. It's sort of like if I'm right-handed and you're trying to ask me to write left-handed. I might be able to do it, but it's completely awkward for me.
Yeah, and if I ask you to keep doing it, you won't.
over time, no, I just get frustrated and can't even do it.
You just won't do it.
Exactly. And so, I mean, one of the things that has come clear in all the people that we've interviewed about the use of the PSI is just one of the words that was used is this word freedom, that I now have an identity with this tool to say, this is who I am, and I am okay with who I am, rather than this sort of negative thing that has come from other tools where it sort of puts you down for who you are and really not accepting self. So tell us a little bit about that and how the tool certainly embraces that.
Well, it has something to do with the three dimensions and the bubble again. People just don't like being cornered or pressed into a certain predefinition of themselves. They resist it. And, you know, the challenge could be that, well, you know, you're just telling people what they want to hear. It's like a horoscope.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not really. We're just holding a mirror up, and it's a pretty well-polished mirror. If people stand honestly in front of it, what they're going to get back is their own image. And that's what we've been able to produce, is a polished mirror that isn't distorted or isn't biased by the designer of the mirror. I mean, we could have made a curved mirror to make heavy people seem slim or slim people seem heavier, but we didn't. We just made it as flat as we could, as straight up as we could, and let people decide what they want to do with that feedback.
In our experience with all the years now, 33 years since the birth of the company, Terry, is that it's the majority of people, I mean, high 90s, it's just transformational for them in whatever context that they take it.
Yeah, it's. I haven't really had hardly any negative feedback at all. Almost everybody that I've seen thousands of people go through it in my classes over the years. They find it valuable personally for them, and they want people they know to complete it so they can have conversations with them about it and get to know them better. It also provides a common language to talk about how we communicate and what our strengths and differences and preferences are. So if we understand somebody in that detailed way, we have a better chance of respecting them and connecting with them in a way that makes them comfortable. And that's really not manipulation. It's just a kind thing to do.
And I become aware and informed and intentional versus just obtuse or unaware or oblivious.
Yep. So I think that's something that happens as people work through not only the PSI but other tools as well that CRG has, is that they become more sensitive to other people's values as well as their styles. They get tuned into other people's stress levels. They go to buy a car. They're aware of how the salesman's coming across and whether it fits their preferences or not, and they'll consciously choose a salesperson that will respect their style preference, or they'll go somewhere else.
Which is a perfect transition. Sorry, Terry. There's a perfect transition to kind of enlighten the group, is that you started with the PSI, and then it expanded into this entire holistic set. So, like, even up front, you always acknowledge that there was more going on for a person than just type, or as other people call it, personality. We call it personal style. That there was all these other things going on. What happened to be able to expand the publishing realm into all of a sudden the job style is there and the sales style and the entrepreneurial? Where did that come out of, where all of a sudden it went beyond the personal style indicator?
Well, once again, it was just driven by need. Because the personal style indicator was so successful, people started asking if we had something that would help them identify their values or other people's values, or define the work behavior style requirements of their job or of a job they're thinking about going to get, or I met a fellow who was heavily into sales training, and he just said, look, why don't we write one for salespeople because we really need this? And I said, great, let's partner and write it. So we did that. And the same with entrepreneurial. It just sort of emerged because people need it. It wasn't like a design where we said, oh, well, let's build a company and make a lot of money. It's like it just came to us.
And as a result of that, it's one of the few tool sets that really acknowledge the diversity of all the different pieces that are going on. So as you mentioned, the stress indicator and health planner, the values preference indicator, or the self-worth or confidence kind of indicator.
Right.
And looking at the entrepreneurial, which has the environmental factors or success factors. So, and then the instructional and learning styles. And then you went and moved from there, where in the 90s you did a lot of work around the understanding of competencies of leadership. So
yeah.
All of a sudden that expanded, and so how did that come about? Why did you focus on that?
Well, because my purpose was to support, encourage, and still is, and support, encourage, and develop leaders who can develop other leaders. And so I quite naturally spent my research during my PhD years looking into the leadership competencies that are known to make people effective leaders. And one of those competencies is the ability to be flexible, the ability to style shift, the ability to shift skills, styles, and roles. And what we found was effective leaders can do that. Less effective leaders don't do it as well. And some of them do just the opposite. In fact, interestingly enough, I'm working with on a project right now with the Los Angeles County Sheriff, and his idea was we need to come up with a devil's list of leadership behaviors that discourage and demoralize people. We need to have an assessment. He said we might not call it the devil's list, but he said he can quote me that that's, you know, what's needed. And it's not out there in the literature anywhere where people want to identify all the different ways that their boss is a jerk. It's a very interesting concept, but as we know, not all that high a percentage of people are happy with their supervisor. And the reason they aren't happy with them is they don't have interpersonal skills, the ones that they're not happy with, don't have interpersonal or problem-solving skills, and their emotional intelligence is not that developed, or their social intelligence as well is not developed. So consequently, we realized that all these assessment tools needed a framework where they could be sandwiched with skills. And in a way, what we found out was being able to assess another person's style is a skill. And being able to develop versatility in how we approach others is another skill. So those skills have gone into the book Transforming Leadership and into the more recently developed book Every Officer Is a Leader, where that book is moving into the criminal justice system and being used by organizations like the FBI and the RCMP. And Los Angeles County Sheriff's, which is the largest policing agency in the world. So I don't think it's any mistake. We're just listening to what people need and trying to give it to them.
Now, in support of your leadership model is, you know, even after looking and reading the various leadership books out there, certainly not all of them because there's over 800 definitions of leadership, but at this point, Terry, I don't think there is another book out there and or model that brings together the competencies of a transforming leader into one spot. I mean, Jim Collins talked about a level 5 leader, but he didn't define the skills. He only said, be a level 5 leader. But what are the skills I need to have to actually even achieve it? So, you know, we've had it for 15 or 17 years.
Yeah, even Jim Kouzis' work, The Leadership Challenge, identifies leadership practices. And in my conversations with Jim, he said, yes, we're able to help people understand what the leadership practices are that people need to get on with. But at the end of a week-long training, some of them say, I need to know what to say and how to say it if I'm going to engage in the practice of encouraging someone's heart. It's not just enough for me to know that I should do it. I need the skills to do it. Mm-hmm. So Jim Kouzis' research is monumentally and groundbreaking and even earth-shaking in terms of its accuracy and predictive validity. But still people need training and learning how to bring forward those qualities of leadership and the practices of leadership. In order to bring those forward, you have to have competencies. And that's what we focused on, were observable behaviors that leaders can learn. They can learn to practice, learn to emanate, and they can model those so other leaders can learn them.
And again, as I said earlier, there's nobody else that I'm aware of that's brought all of that together into one spot, into one model. There's pieces all over out there, but yep, not one that's brought into a comprehensive one-stop sort of model.
I don't think so. I don't think there is. The only place I've seen anything that comes close to it is in the counselor education field at the master's and PhD levels. Gerard Egan has written a book that summarizes the counseling and problem management skills that people need in order to be effective counselors.
Is that the Skilled Helper?
Yeah, it's the Skilled Helper book, which is the number one best-selling counseling education book in the world. Well, Jerry Egan sat on my PhD committee and wrote the foreword to the first edition of Transforming Leadership. And his work was, I think, pivotal. And as I reviewed the literature in self-management and communication and problem-solving and team development and organization development, I found out there were competency clusters that were verified by research to be predictably effective. They were like core competencies that you had to have in order to get results and in order to perform confidently. And we just isolated those and elucidated those in the book, Transforming Leadership.
And it's interesting because a lot of the tools that we've already talked about are underpinned or slotted into the Transforming Leadership model. So my knowledge of personal style, my knowledge of my personal values and the values of the people around me, how's my stress and wellness levels as it affects my work with others, how the job style comes in, the matching the right people, and all of those integrated into that Transforming Leadership model. So this really does provide a holistic package for other individuals. So I appreciate you, Terry, for all the work that you did around that to bring that into one place, because most other people just wouldn't take the time to do it.
Well, it just quite naturally came into being, just from shoveling through the research and finding patterns and distilling them into competencies. It just became more and more clear that these are the things that people need to learn how to do if they want to become more effective. And we've seen people learn the skills and become demonstrably more effective in a short period of time, like a matter of months.
And, you know, that's being validated by recent leadership work, where I think actually the leadership skills has come into its own just recently, though it's been there for a while, where long-term development projects, and I won't mention the names here, have now seen the transformation occurring, where they benchmark with the leadership skills inventory, then they establish the development plan and have a coaching and a development plan in place for months, not days or weeks or just the program, and see a significant shift in the supervisory and management skills 6 months and a year later.
Yeah, and the literature on social intelligence and emotional intelligence is now indicating that all of that has a tremendous effect on supervisory and managerial effectiveness that impacts the bottom line of business organizations.
And just morale and productivity and all the things that go into it. You mentioned earlier about the research on leadership competency. CIRIC, I forget, it stands for something here in Canada, did the research and said that individuals, 70% of people thought that their supervisor or leader was incompetent.
Yeah, I mean, there are different studies that have been done that have different percentages, and some are high and some are moderate, but none of the scores are low. And it's not the supervisor's fault. They just haven't had an opportunity to learn the skills because they're just not taught very many places.
It hasn't really been part of the value set, or the organization just isn't equipped to teach it, or they haven't even known that they don't know that they don't know.
Yeah. It's only been in the last 10 years that the most progressive medical schools and law schools are training people in interpersonal skills and problem-solving skills. So before, if you got an MD degree, it was presumed that you knew what you knew. You knew enough to go out and start your own practice and be a professional. But it just, as we all know from going to different doctors over the years, we know that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, if you've ever been to a lawyer, you know that it's great when you find one who actually has the ability to understand you and take the time to help you understand what's going on in a legal situation.
Where some of them do not.
No, and of course, doctors are historically criticized for their lack of bedside manner.
So they're technicians, but they're certainly not, and even though every one of their clients is a live person.
Yeah, but it's not really their fault. It's not really their fault. They invested hundreds of thousands of dollars into their medical education, and their university that they happened to choose just didn't happen to have the training for them to learn these skills. I mean, I remember one of my own doctors, Dr. Okana, after he got his MD degree, he felt that he was not really fully equipped to practice medicine, so he went back and got a degree in counseling. And he's probably the most effective doctor that I've ever had.
Oh, and I've met him, too. I mean, he's a great gentleman, but he has a real passion for transforming people as well. But
I've referred over 500 people to him.
And so that goes to show you that if I do develop transforming leadership skills or communication skills, that I'm going to get a lot of referrals. Things are just going to be better for me, period.
And your work is going to be more satisfying because you're going to be more effective.
At all levels. So, Terry, we spent, over 45 minutes kind of having a conversation, but maybe we can just finish up with this of, you know, where was your heart in this whole thing about, you know, what was your vision for CRG and the tools and the PSI about what it was going to do to people? And why so many people, I know this is at the verge of self-promotion, why so many people prefer our tools over others in the marketplace? Just kind of sum that up and say, you know, what was at the heart of the matter? And then really your experience of working with thousands of people over the years about why they really prefer our tools over others that are out there.
Well, the bulk of people in the marketplace don't prefer our tools over the others because they don't know about them. But the ones who actually do take the time to learn about them, we see about 80% of them stop using the other tools that they've been using. And these are counselors and trainers and educators and other people in the human development field, career planners. They just, once they understand the distinctiveness and the comprehensiveness of the model and of the tools, they just quite naturally prefer to use them because their clients prefer to use them. And they're also less expensive than most of the high-end tools out there that where you can't even access them without having an appointment made with a professional to interpret the results for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this is self-administering, self-interpreting, instant feedback and instant usefulness. In a sense, we remember we had the discussion of sitting around a table, you and I with some other people, Ken, and we talked about we wanted to be able to give psychology away.
Right.
The best, most useful psychology.
And it's also something that we do with them, not to them.
Exactly, which is different from the medical or the psychiatric model, which typically takes the approach of diagnosis and prescription. And I am the doctor, you are the patient, which is appropriate if you're diagnosing bacterial infection or the kind of cancer somebody has. It's highly appropriate, but not appropriate when you're solving complex social and interaction problems. So I guess my vision that I have always had for the tools and for CRG is that it would have a transformational effect on people's lives, and their own lives being transformed would change families and improve workplaces and give people more opportunities for development and the realization of their potentials at all levels.
Mm-hmm. And that we really are equipping them to win and creating an interdependent, if not an independent, relationship with us versus a codependent one where we're teaching you how to fish.
Right. Well, I think the codependent one is you have to go fishing with me, but I'm going to catch all the fish. But you have to pay for the bait and the line and the tackle. And we're just saying, no, look, we're going to teach you how to fish, and you go do your own fishing.
And if you want to call me about some fishing tips a little bit along the way, then give us a call, and we'll help you on how to do better with what you've got there.
Yep.
And really sort of a relationship rather than this kind of practitioner looking down at you. Well, Terry, I appreciate you spending the time for our listeners and just sharing the CRG story, your philosophy, different directions. Any final comments that you want to have to those people that will be listening to this or potentially reading this in a transcript?
Just be at peace. Be still. And you'll know
what?
Ultimately, potentially everything that there is to know that you can know. I just think we live in a world that's so hurried and distracting that so many people find it extremely difficult to sit down and be still and take some time to really get to know themselves and really hear their own inner voice and their own identity and their own sense of calling and their own sense of connectedness to life itself and to the source of life.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting because Richard actually, Nodell said this, that the reason that people aren't satisfied in their jobs is that they have not been prepared nor done the work.
Mm.
The personal work.
Yeah,
personal search, the personal journey, the commitment to self to be clear about who one is and the gifts and talents and abilities and preferences that they bring to bear and that they clearly know what those are.
Right. That takes some discovery and some shoveling and cleaning out the barn to find all that out.
And so, well, we thank you for your vision from 3 decades ago and your commitment, you know, to creating a tool set that is designed for the learner to be able to achieve all those things, Terry. And
yeah.
I think that you won't know the impact of all the people and the lives that have been changed through that work until even later. So it'll be unknown.
If I ever know.
And you might know, but it might not be here.
Yeah.
So I thank you for taking the time, Terry, and be able to share your insights and wisdom with the people that are listening. So thanks for spending the time with us.
Thank you.